Okay, we're in Parshas Shlach, page 798 in the Stone Chumashim, Pasuk Yudches, three lines in the end of the page. The story is that Moshe Rabbeinu is sending the spies, like we discussed at great length, why they sinned, what they wanted, what they didn't want, why Moshe sent them, if Hashem didn't want, all that stuff we discussed. So general rules we discussed, now we're just going into the details. Here. Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jews, like the spies like this, what is the mission? Moshe Rabbeinu is giving them a mission in the spying. He's giving them specific instructions of what to do. You should see the land, mahu, what it is. And the nation which is sitting in the land, that dwells there. He says like this, find out if they're strong, if they're weak. If there's a few people, a lot of people, check out the land basically. Well, I'm going to learn a few psukim, then we're going to discuss. And what is the land? That the people are dwelling there. Is it a good land? Is it a bad land? And what are the cities that the people live them in them? Are they open cities? Are they closed cities? Okay. And what is the land? Ashmenehi imraza. Is it a fertile land? Is it a lean land? Hayesh ba'et samayin. Are there trees there? If not trees, because chazaktem, you should strengthen yourself. Olakachtem mepri ha'aretz, you should take from the fruit of the land. Vayamim you may be kurianovim. And it says the days were the season of the ripening of the grapes. They basically, if you take the pasuk just in a literal point of view, Moshe Rabbeinu is a general. He said, listen, we need to spy out the land. Are they strong? Are they weak? Open cities, fortified cities, good land, bad land, fertile land, not fertile land. Which, some of these points make sense. Some of these points you have to think from and don't make sense. Okay, if the point is how to conquer the land, I understand. Are they strong? Are they weak? Are they a lot? Are they many? Are they open cities, closed cities? But, like, if the land is fertile, who cares? I mean, what does that have to do with the strategy of war? I mean, if you think about it, why is that important? Is there a tree? Is there no tree? Who cares if there are trees? I mean, you plant. JNF will plant trees. I mean, like, what's this thing with the trees or not? And also, there's a difficulty over here, because from the mission, Rashi says like this. When Moshe Rabbeinu said to the spies, check out if the land is, if they live in open cities or closed cities. So the way Rashi explains it is like this, because not everybody agrees with Rashi. Rashi says like this, if they live in open cities without walls around it, that means they're strong. That means they're not afraid of anybody. If they live in closed cities, that means they're afraid, they need protection. So that shows they're weak. When the spies came back, we'll learn later, the spy said, they're strong and the cities are fortified. It's like, according to Rashi, it doesn't make sense. Because Rashi says, Moshe Rabbeinu says to them, listen, if they live in walled cities, that means they're scared. Right? That means they're weak. If they live in open cities, that means they're not afraid of anybody. Yet they come back and say, it's just the opposite. They're strong and they live in fortified cities. It's like, what's Moshe Rabbeinu telling them? What is the point to do? So a lot of Mefarshim explain that over here the open cities and the closed cities is not only if they're strong or weak. Some Mefarshim disagree with Rashi and his interpretation. And Rashi has a reason why he said what he says. But some Mefarshim learn that open cities are easy to conquer. You don't have to go through the wall. You don't have to break a wall. You just go straight into the land. There's a very interesting halacha that the Rebbe would always quote in Hilchas Shabbos about the security in Eretz Yisrael today. There's a din that on Shabbos, if enemies are coming to kill you, so then you have to go fight on Shabbos. You have to go defend yourself because they don't want to kill you. If they're only coming for monetary things, then you're not allowed to desecrate Shabbos because for money you don't desecrate Shabbos. What happens though, if it's a port city, So over there the din is, even if they just come for iske kash v'tevin, meaning even if they're just coming about straw, like worthless things, you have to desecrate Shabbos and go out and kill them. Why? Because once they conquer a port city, the whole land is now open. It's like sometimes when they have an open city, and by conquering that, then the whole place is open. Right? Like when the Jews went into Israel with Yericho, Jericho had a wall around it, and the wall fell down on Shabbos, and the Jews just went into the city and conquered it. Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu is telling them in tactics of war, like, find out exactly the strength, not the strength of whatever it is. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu also wanted, does it have reliable, what does it mean if it's good or it's bad? If you know, the pasuk is repeating itself, it's like this. Are the cities good or bad? Are they fertile? Are they not fertile? So then what's the definition of good and bad? So therefore, the Mefarshim learn, good means, is there a good ample water supply? And is the air good? Does the air, because that also involves in the greatness of the city. Now, was the rich in sense, when he says, was it rich or poor? Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to know, is there business opportunities? Is there not business opportunities? Now, a lot of it, obviously, as far as Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned, Moshe Rabbeinu was not sending the Jews to see if they could conquer the land. They couldn't already. The question was not if, the question was how. So Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping that the spies would come back and speak about the fertile land and about the good land and the great land and how beautiful the land is. That would inspire the Jews more so to go into Eretz Yisrael. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was not sending the spies from his part to see if we could conquer the land. Okay, only how to do it. But Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping that they would come back and be good news to give the spirit. You know, when you go to war, you need to have a good spirit, that you march a victory, you know, to be able to win the war. So this is what Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping. The fact is, they used all of this that Moshe Rabbeinu told them to do in a negative way. Like Moshe Rabbeinu said, bring back from the fruits. Yeah? So they brought back fruits, but not for a positive reason. Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping to bring back beautiful fruits, see what land we're coming into. They used it for negativity, as we'll soon learn. So all these psukim basically is going on with Moshe Rabbeinu is hoping what the Jews would do, and if not. Now, another interpretation, Ayesh Ba'etz, Rashi learns, the Kleyoka learns a little bit differently, but the Rashi learns, Ayesh Ba'etz means, just like a tree protects people from the sun, he wanted to know, are there any tzaddikim there? Are there any holy people that we're going to have a problem with, because in their merit, Hashem might not give us over the land? And in fact, the Medrash says, according to one opinion, when the Meraglim came to Israel, Eov, Job, according to that opinion, that Eov existed, and that he existed at this time. There's a whole argument in the Gemara, by the way, the famous Eov story, Job. Okay, there's an argument in the Gemara Bava Basra, like four or five opinions, when Eov lived, if he lived. One opinion says, Eov lahoyev alei nivra. One opinion the Gemara says it's refuted, but one opinion the Gemara says Job never existed. It's an analogy and a moshul and the whole thing, you know. And then, one opinion says he lived in the time of Avram. One opinion says he lived in the time of Pari. One time he lived in this time. But the Gemara says that Hashem made Eev die, that the people of Israel should be so occupied, preoccupied with the burial of Eev, that they won't have time to notice the spies. Okay? Another thing we said before, we didn't mention this last week. When it says, Alu Zeba Negev, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Alu Zeba Negev, okay? Go up in the south, we said last week, we explained, because first you look at the junk, and then you go to the better land. But the Mefarshim asks, why does it say Alu Zeba Negev? Like, what's Zeh? Alu Ba Negev. In Hebrew, you say Alu Ba Negev, go up in the south. What Alu Zeba Negev? So, there's one opinion in the Medrash that says that Zer refers to the stick of Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem said to Moshe at the burning bush, Ma zer biyodecha? What do you have in your hand? And he said, a stick. So Hashem said, throw the stick, it turned into a snake, and then he held it, it turned back. So Zer, the Medrash says, refers to the stick. It's Moshe Rabbeinu's famous stick that he hit the rock and he did all the miracles with. So it says in the Medrash that Moshe Rabbeinu said, Alu Zeh, take the stick with you. And Moshe Rabbeinu said that any time you're going to see giants and people that you're going to be afraid of, just put the stick out and they're all going to tremble. And the Medrash says, any place the Meraglim went, by the way, the giants were trembling because they showed him the stick. Another opinion said he showed him Zeh, he gave him the name of God, Zeh equals 12. There's a name of God that puts 12 letters, officially, whatever. It's different ways of figuring things. But, because certain names of God end up to be 12 letters. So he said, he gave him the name of God. Moshe Rabbeinu is telling them, basically, check it out and go further. Okay, so he says like this. Ayesh ba'etim ayin, see if there's an eight or not. The Gemara says a kosher person. Okay? Now, there's another interesting interpretation. The Klayaker says it's an unbelievable interpretation when he defines this pasuk. He says like this. First though, he says, later on, it says in Chumash, Sor Tzilam Me'alehem. Tzilam means their rock, their shadow, their protection. Tzilam, Tzadik, Lamed Mem, is the same numerical value as 8, 3. Tzilam is Tzadik, Lamed Mem. Lamed Mem is Ayin, right? Lamed is 30 and 40, equals 70. So 8 equals the same numerical value as tzilam, they mean the protection. So the Kliyakir says in a deeper meaning, what does it mean, a yeshbo eitzimayin? Do they have a tree or not? Okay, but he interprets it like this. The Jew said, one time the Jew said, hayesh, what's the expression? Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Is God within us or not? So the commentators explain at that time, the Jews didn't deny the existence of God. They didn't say, Hayesh Hashem im ayin. They didn't say, is there God or not? They said, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Is God in us or not? Okay? You could believe in God. The question is God in you or not? And this is what, at that time, by Amalek, or those things, the Jews questioned, not is there a God, but Ayesh Hashem bekirbeinu, kirbeinu means in us, is God in us or not? And he says, that's the thing. Hayesh bo eitz in ayin. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say, Hayesh eitz or ayin. He could have said, look, Hayesh eitz or ayin, is there a tree or not? He said, Hayesh bo eitz in ayin, meaning, the eitz, the tzaddik. Is he involved in the people? Is he in the country to protect them? Or he has nothing to do with the people? So Moshe Rabbeinu is telling him, not only do I want you to see if there's a tzaddik, but I want you to go see if there's a tzaddik that's going to protect those people or not. Just not the, if there's a tzaddik, to see how far he's going to do it. Okay, so he says like this. The days were the days of Bikurei Anovim, when grapes begin to ripe, that was the time he sent them to Eretz Yisrael or not, to go to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so it says like this. Vayalu vayasura sa'oretz, they went up, and they checked out the land, from Mibetzin ad Rechev levei Chamos. They walked the entire width and length of Eretz Yisrael. The Meraglim, actually, in 40 days, they walked the entire length and width of Eretz Yisrael, which in itself is a miracle. The Mefarshim explained, the Gemara says, Eretz Yisrael is 400 parsa by 400 parsa. Now, a parsa is 4 mil. Okay? A mil is less than a mile, but it's much less than a mile. But just let's use miles, it'd be easier. A parsa is 4 miles. 400 parsa, let's say for argument's sake, is 1,600 miles by 1,600. It's much less, but 1,600 miles by 1,600 miles. The Gemara says basically it's a square. The original biblical Israel, not today. Today it's a small little... Then it was a square. The borders were much bigger. Sure. So the Gemara says an average person can walk 10 parsa a day. Okay? Eretz Yisrael was 400 parsa by 400 parsa. Now just think about it. If one day you walk 10 parsa, so 40 days, you walk 400 parsa. But that's really only one direction. But the pasuk says they went all the directions. So how did they go so fast? So Rashi calls in the Medrash, and from the Gemara and Saita, that Hashem made a miracle that it should only take them 40 days. Why? It should have really taken them either 80 days or 120 days. No, I mean 160 days. But the answer is, Hashem knew they were going to come back. And because of the 40 days, they're going to have to spend 40 years in the desert. Hashem had pity on them. He didn't want them to stay in the desert 160 years. Or 80 years, whatever. So Hashem made a miracle that the Meraglim should go so fast that in 40 days they finish what should have taken either 80 or 160 days. And they did it in 40 days. So it's mamish a big miracle. But
how could they not be noticed?
Who said they weren't noticed? I'm going to wait. Meshi Rabbeinu said to them, check out, are there big people, small people, strong people, weak people? The Jews were like grasshoppers compared to, we'll see, we'll learn it. Vayalu vayasur ha-roretz, he went, mimid batzin ad rechev levei Hamas, to come to Hamas. Vayalu ba-negev, they went up in the south, like Meshi Rabbeinu told them, vayovoy ad chevrin, and they came to, he came to Chevron. Doesn't say they came to Chevron. Says they went up in the south, and he came to Chevron. So Rashi said from the Gemara, what was he came to Chevron? Kalev. Kalev left the rest of the spies, and he went himself to Chevron to pray at Ma'aras HaMachpelah. He said, Moshe Rabbeinu prayed for Yeshua. He didn't pray for me. So I need to go pray that I shouldn't. He already saw what's going on with the spies. He said, let me daven that Hashem should save me. Because of this, it says later in the book of Yeshua that the city of Chevron was given to Kalev. The whole city, when they divided up Israel, the city of Chevron was given to Kalev himself. In the reward of the fact that he went himself to pray at Ma'aras HaMachpelah. By the way, you know, there's a very interesting halacha. It's not halacha, it's a minig. And it's disproved by poskim from this posik. You ever hear there's a custom that some people have, if you didn't go to a grave of a parent for 7 years, you're not allowed to go anymore. You ever hear that?
Yeah.
Is that, huh?
Yeah.
You ever hear it? It's brought down, there is such a custom that if you didn't go to a grave of a parent for 7 years, you don't go. It's a custom which is brought down in halacha. In the post can bring it down. Some people say 10 years, some people say 7 years. Lepoil, in most places today, they don't hold of that custom. They do go. And they bring a proof from Kalev. Kali went to Marsa Machpelah. Nobody was there for who knows how many hundreds of years. Right? Nobody was in Marsa Machpelah since Yaakov Avinu was buried. No, so it's already 80. No, it was, a few generations from Yaakov Avinu. Huh? A little bit less than 200 years. No, but after Yosef died, okay, it was less than 200 years. It was less than 200 years. 150 years. So you see that they still went to Marsa Machpelah. So they use this pasuk as a source for it. Okay, so then it says like this. Vayalu banega vayove yad chevren. The shaman the sit of over there was Achimon, Sheshai, Vesalmai. These were giants. Sheshai, Salmai, Yelidi, Anok, the children of the giants. The Chevrin Sheva Shonim Nivna, so Chevron was built 7 years before Tzayan Mitzrayim, before Tzayan in Egypt. So right away, there's a long Rashi over here. Rashi asks the question, what does it mean it was built before Tzayan Mitzrayim? Because Rashi says that how could he build Chevron for Canaan before Tzayan to Mitzrayim, which was an older son? Meaning, Chom, Nerech son, right? Shem Chom and Yafes. So Chom had a son, Canaan, and he had a son, Mitzrayim. Okay? So Rashi says, how did he build Chevron for Canaan before he built Tzayan for Mitzrayim, who is older than Canaan? When the Torah enumerates the kids of Chom, Mitzrayim is older than Canaan. Okay? So here it says, he built, Mitzrayim was older than Canaan. So here he says, he built the city of the Chevron 7 years before he built Tzayan in Egypt. How do you build a city for your younger son before you build a city for the older son? Doesn't make sense. Right, he gets married first, whatever. So therefore Rashi quotes from the Gemara that it doesn't mean that. It means like this. The worst part of Israel is Chevron. Not in Kedusha. As far as fertile goes. That's where there's a lot of cemeteries there. Cemeteries you put in non-fertile land. You don't waste fertile land on cemeteries. Cemeteries you put in land which is not fertile. Tzayan, the pasuk says, was the most fertile place in Egypt. So what the pasuk Rashi says in the Gemara is actually saying that the worst place in Israel, Chevron, was seven times better than the most fertile land of Egypt. It has the junkiest land, so to speak, fertilization wise, not in Kedusha, Chevron's holy city, in the fertilization aspect, the junkiest piece of land of Egypt, of Eretz Yisrael, was seven times better than the most fertile land of Egypt. And that's what the pasuk says. Okay? Now, by Yaveya Nachal Eshkol, they came to Nachal Eshkol, and we're going to see that's why they called the place Nachal Eshkol, but this is the name of the city they came. By Yichrusu Misham Zmeira, they cut a vine with one cluster of grapes. Vayesul b'meit b'shnayim, they bored on a double pole. Umin arimeinim imin ata'inim. And from the pomegranates and from the figs. So the way the Gemara explains it, they had like this. There were 12 guys. 12 spies. 8 of them carried one cluster of grapes. It was so big, and the way... I have a picture of it here. No, here they don't have a picture of it. In other Chumashim, they have a picture of the cluster. Here also not. The cluster of grapes, the different Mefarshim. You know what? Okay, this is the Mamleis. The different opinions, actually, and even in the Gemara, in Rashi. This is like, these poles are, they had two double poles that, with 8 ends of the poles. That means there were 4 poles. Carrying one cluster, one bunch of grapes, and there are 4 poles, has 8 ends to it. So 8 of the spies carried one cluster of grapes. Okay? And then one carried a fig, and one gerit of pomegranate. It's 10. And as Rashi says from the Gemara, Kalev and Yeshua didn't carry anything. And we'll explain soon why. Why they didn't take anything. But it's interesting. And Rashi makes a cheshbon. Rashi makes an interesting calculation over here. There's later on Psukim, when they came into the Yarden, the river, the Jordan River, when they crossed it, Yeshua told them to pick up these big rocks and carry it with them to Israel as a sign to show, you see, these were the rocks we got from the bottom of the Jordan River. You know, to prove that God split the Jordan. The Gemara says that they weighed 40 saw each. Okay? 40 saw each. Here they don't make it in our calculations. Now, one man can carry a load of 40 saw. We'll soon see what that is. The Gemara says, what you can pick up yourself is only a third of what if somebody else helps you pick up. You know, when two people help pick up something, it's not just double the strength. Each one is only a third of what they could do when two people are doing it. Okay? So you picture now, if one man could carry a stone 40 saw, and 8 people carried one cluster of grapes, he said, you can't imagine how big that cluster of grapes was. And the Medrash says, the Mamleis brings down, that there was a river of wine flowing from that cluster of grapes.
Natural wine.
Yeah. Well, grape juice. It didn't age, so it was grape juice. And then one of them carried a big pomegranate, and one of them carried a big fig. Okay? This is what they each one carried. Now, so the question is, if Moshe Rabbeinu told them to bring back fruit, why did Yeshua and Kalev not carry anything? Gemara says Yeshua and Kalev didn't carry anything. So there's two opinions why Yeshua and Kalev didn't carry. One is because they were very prominent. Yeshua was the future leader. Kalev was, you know, so it was below their dignity, so to speak, to carry it. But the question is, when below your dignity? As Moshe Rabbeinu told them, look after me, to go bring back the fruits. Right? So why didn't they? So therefore there's a second answer. The second answer, Rashi says, is because they understood why the spies are bringing it back. Why did the spies bring back such monstrous fruits? It wasn't to speak good about the land. It was to scare the people about the land. They came back and they said, you see how monstrous the foods are? Can you imagine how monstrous the people are? I mean, just picture how many grapes you, how many figs you eat. Can picture this one fig. You can imagine. So the Meraglim came back with negative. Their intent was negativity. Their intent was to speak bad about the land. Moshe Rabbeinu said, bring the fruits. His intention was they should bring back with good intent. They came back, their purpose of bringing the fruits was against the will of Moshe Rabbeinu. See, Yeshua and Kalev said, that's not what Moshe Rabbeinu wanted. So, therefore, there's no way we're going to actually do it. Because with Moshe Rabbeinu, he was concerned about the method. He wanted the result that the fruit should inspire the people. Here, not only did the fruits not inspire the people, it turned them against Eretz Yisrael, and therefore Yeshua and Kalev said, that's not what Moshe Rabbeinu... So therefore, like they explain, the fact that there were prominent people, many commentators reject that reason, because if Moshe Rabbeinu told them to bring it, what's it mean? It's just below your dignity to listen to Moshe Rabbeinu. He told you to bring back fruits, you bring back fruits. Therefore, the more accepted opinion is, their intent was completely bad. And Yeshua and Kalev said, we want to have nothing to do, even at the risk of not listening to Moshe Rabbeinu, but they understood the reason of Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore they said, there's no reason, there's no way we're going to bring it. Pardon? Yeah.
Did they travel together or they went?
No, it says Vayalu. No, they went together. Vayalu Banegev. Only Techevim Kalev separated himself and then he rejoined them. They went all together. If you look, it says Vayalu Banegev in Pasuch of Gimel. It's a Vayavoyhu. They came together.
They were all the time together.
Just the navigation alone is a miracle. Well, they had GPS. And the donkey.
How come Caleb went to everyone? He knew that it's going to be, he need extra power. And Joshua, he gets a yud, it's not fair. When he gets the yud, it's not fair. It's not something that is fair.
Okay, so I'm going to go back a little bit to answer your question, which we find another interesting thing. When Moshe Rabbeinu changed his name from Hosea to Yehoshua, right? Yeah, and he said, God should protect you from the advice of the spies. Okay, so the Mefarshim explain what really happened over here is as follows. If you notice, it says Lemati Hefroyim Hosea ben Nun. When he's mentioning the spies, he's called Hosea ben Nun. After all 12 are picked, then he changes the name Yeshua. Okay, so the Mefarshim say, why didn't he change the name before? Before he said these are the names, he should have changed the name then. Right? And what did Moshe Rabbeinu say? The Lord is going to answer your question, by the way. Hashem should save him from the advice of the Meraglim. And the unity of the Meraglim did them in. Meaning like this. The Meraglim as separate individuals were all tzaddikim. But they had nothing to do with each other. This one was in Yehuda, this one was Yosef, Ephraim, Menashe, Reuven, Shimon, Levi. They were each leaders of their own tribes. Not the Nesiim, but they were leaders in their own tribes. They never had a meeting, so to speak. Each person on their own was holy. After they got together, it says that they probably had a meeting, the Meraglim. When Moshe Rabbeinu saw the meeting, you know, sometimes in show politics also, sometimes you call a meeting, that's when everything gets killed. You know, no, really. You know, in business also, in organizations, everybody who ever is on the board would know this, who was ever on the board, Oliver Shalom. But I'm saying, when you have an individual, you can deal with them individually. Once they get together, then that's a group power, is very difficult to fight. So when Moshe picked them as individuals, they were all holy people. And therefore, there was no need to change his name, Hosea, because they were all good. What was the problem? After he picked them, and it says, El Shmeitzah Anashim, that Moshe Rabbeinu sent to spy the land, so then they had a meeting. This is what the Mefarshim explained. They had a meeting, and at the meeting, Moshe Rabbeinu saw the Atzas Meraglim, it's going in the meeting. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, now I'm going to daven for Yeshua. The Meraglim went as a group. That was their problem. Then, because they went and they stuck together as a group, except Yeshua and Kalev. Huh?
Like the Battle of
Towers. Yeah, but...
And they were united.
They were united.
Power of meaning and negativity is also strong in negative side. Right?
Power of a group in negative, sure.
Just like when 10 Jews get together, it's so holy, the opposite
to
happen.
Even in school, when 10 kids are rowdy, if you talk to each one individually, you can accomplish much more than speaking to a bunch of 10 wilde chayes. Wild animals. No, and the power of you is a negative power. Really, that they're coming up, and then that's when the Atzas, once the Meraglim started giving Atzas, once they met, that's when they started giving advice between each other. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu is afraid of.
Could it be that they really were afraid of the giants?
They physically, no.
No.
Especially if you say that he gave him the stick, and then there's nothing.
It's the same Yud, the same A, but with Sarah, it's always the same letters.
Yeah, yeah. We mentioned that last week. Yeah. Mokamahu Karta Nachal Eshkol. That place the Meraglim called Nachal Eshkol. Why? Alodeisa Eshkol, about the Eshkol that Koshim Misham B'nai Yisrael, that the Jews cut there. Okay. Vayoshuvu mitur ha'aretz, they came back from spying the land, miketa boimyein. And like we said before, it was really a miracle that they came back after 40 days rather than longer, because Hashem didn't want the Jews to stay in Israel, in the desert, for much, much longer than that.
This what? Was the whole land or part of the land?
They went through the whole land. They went the length and width. You know, the Rashi says from the Medrash, Tanchumet, that that's what it was.
But is it all the lands that Hashem mentioned?
All the seven lands, yeah. What?
In retrospect, is there a lesson to learn, like it would have been better that they didn't send us five? And then they would just...
What do you mean in retrospect? After something happened, I know what retrospect means. After something happens, like... What do you want? What do you want to learn? What they should have done?
No, like a lot of times, we want to do something.
But like we learned before you came back, Yeshua sent spies to Yericho and it was great.
No, I understand.
Later on, Chumash Moshe Rabbeinu sent spies.
But sometimes we have a challenge to just do it rather than to try to figure the whole thing out. Maybe
that's why Hashem said, sometimes the less you think. Intellect contradicts doing what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a fundamental, not only in Hasidus, in Musar, in all aspects of Yiddishkeit. Just picture the following scenario. God calls up the head, yeah, and he says, head, I want you to put yourself into boiling hot water. Command from God. Head, take yourself and put you into boiling hot water. The head is super intelligence, seichu. So the head said, did he mean me? Maybe he meant somebody else. Maybe he meant tomorrow. Maybe he meant I should cool it off. Maybe he doesn't really mean it. You know, that's what intellect does, you know. So the head is not going to do it so fast. Comes the brainless foot. Foot has no seichel, no brain. Hashem calls up the foot and says, foot, go into hot water. So what does that foot do? It jumps into hot water. It doesn't know anything. Right? It's brainless. There's no seichel in the foot.
Right, no?
Huh?
The foot.
So I'm saying the brain, yeah, but I'm saying, you understand what I'm saying? Because there's no seichel. Seichel is a contradiction to doing what you're supposed to be doing. And therefore, a Jew, when they do things, they're supposed to do it because this is what Hashem said and told them to do. When Hashem told the Jews, you're going into Eretz Yisrael, the Jews should have said, yes, we're ready to go. Once intellect mixes into it, you will never get it done. When a Jew is giving a mission to do by Hashem, the less you think about it, there's a Yiddish expression, winzige tracht, noch winzige gerät, und mehr getan. Nobody knows what I'm talking about. Little thinking, even less talking, and more doing. That's the exact definition of this. Winzige tracht means little thinking. Noch winzige gerät means even less talking. Und mehr getan and more doing. Okay? When a Jew is given a mission, and this is the lesson of the Meraglim, not from the retrospect of it. When a Jew is given a mission, a Jew is told to jump. The question is, how high? Not when, if, how. The question, how high? That is a soldier. That's a soldier. Instead, the Meraglim teaches us from the negative aspect of the Meraglim, we learn that, you see, that the people, once they start questioning, come back with these terrible reports. Okay.
Rabbi, also, at the same time, they were thinking that, you know, we're comfortable here. Why?
Yeah, I mean, that's why they weren't so bad as they look. That's why they're not as bad as they look, because they wanted to stay in the desert to learn and to daven and to do all that. Okay. They went and they came. So the question is, this pasuk doesn't make sense. The pasuk already says they came back. Yeah? So then the pasuk says now, they went and they came back. What does it mean? So again, the Gemara says what it means is, just like they came back with bad news, they went with bad news. We liken the going and the coming. That's what the pasuk is teaching us now. They went and they came. It said already they went. It says already they came. It means they went like the same way they came. They came to the desert of Parim where the Jews were in Kadesha. They came back and they said to the whole community, and they showed them the fruit of the land. You see these monstrous fruits? Look. This is what we're getting ourselves into. They told Moshe Rabbeinu, they said, we came to the land that you sent us to. And this is a beautiful country flowing with milk and honey. But, Ephes, but. So Rashi learns here, brings down from the Gemara, a remarkable lesson. From here the Gemara learns, if you want to lie, start off with a little bit of truth. Because then people will believe you. When did the Meragim come back? They didn't right away say the land's no good. They said, yeah, Begam Zavas Chalav Devashi, it's a land of milk and honey, it's a beautiful land, which is true. Then they started the lies. In fact, the Mefarshim explained, not here, but in different places, this is the word sheked, which means false, lying. That itself shows us this concept. There's an expression in Chazal, maybe it's even a pasuk, sheked ein lo raglayim. Falseness has no feet. Meaning there's no foot to stand on, because it's lie. Like, and once you keep lying, you dig your hole deeper and deeper and deeper. Like those, remember Nixon and Watergate. You keep digging your hole, and remember, the more lies, and you dig your own grave. So the Gemara, the Mefarshim explained like this. How do you spell sheker? Shin kuf resh. Okay. Now, in order for something to stand, as the English expression is, you need to stand on 2 feet. Okay. Now, the letter sheker, shin kuf resh. Kuf has one leg. Resh has one leg. That's right. It has no feet to it. So therefore, how does sheker begin? With a shin. A shin is a whole base. How does the shin look? There's a whole base at the bottom. It's a firm standing. So the Gemara, the Mefarshim explained that the word sheked itself shows, start off with a shin, with truth, and then say the lie, kuf and resh. And then people will believe you. And this is what the Meraglim, they were very smart. They came back and they said truth. The land is great. But this word that Ramban explains and others explain, that this word Ephes was unbelievable. Bad. Okay? Ephes ki am azaham ayeshibarit. The problem is the nation is too strong. But in Betsudas Gedelus Ma'ed, and the cities are fortified all the way up. We saw the children of the giants. Meaning it's a country full of giants. It's a country full of fortified cities. And and so on. Now, the Klal Yoker asks, like we mentioned before, here, he asks in Rashi, Moshe Rabbeinu told him that if they're open cities, they're strong, if they're closed cities, they're weak. And here they come back and say both things together. So he says like this, Moshe Rabbeinu, in Pasuk Yud Ches, I have to go back to it now because this is where it's explained. Moshe Rabbeinu in Pasuk Yud Ches says to the people like this. Normally when you speak, you first start off with good and then bad. Right? You don't start with bad and then good. You go good and then bad. Especially tzaddikim, first good and then bad. Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jews, I want you to see Hechazaku Harofeh. Are the people strong or weak? Now, what's better for the Jews? If the, no, they're weak. The Jews can conquer the people of the land, not the Jews. Right? So the cheder for the Jews, weak would be better. Moshe Rabbeinu should have said, find out, are they weak? Or are they strong? And then he says, Habamachanim, are they in open cities? Or b'mitzarim, or weaker cities? So he explains like this. There's an advantage both ways. There's an advantage both ways. Open cities, from one side it shows they're strong, but they're easier to conquer because the city is open. Fortified cities are harder to conquer, but it shows the people are weak. So Moshe Rabbeinu is telling them, from either way of looking at it, it's going to be good. Because if they're strong, fortified cities, that means the people are weak, which is good for us. If they're open cities, that means they're strong, but again, it's an open city, so it's easy. So Moshe Rabbeinu is telling them, check out the good of the land. What did these guys come back? And they said both negatives together. They said they're strong and the cities are fortified. So any weakness that we would have been able to accomplish, they said, forget it. Moshe Rabbeinu found maybe the weak, that weak is good. Open city is good. So check it out. So they came back and said, no. The land has every possible fault. The people are strong, which is no good for us. The cities are fortified, which is no good for us. They came back and said, it's really bad. And this is what, so Rashi said what he said, because the fact is, open city is a sign of weakness. A sign of strength, but at the same time, it's a sign of easier to conquer. And they came back and they said it the other way. And then they continued. Amalek Yeshiv Eretz HaNegev. The land of the country of Amalek is sitting in the, where are we up to here? Yeah, Amalek Yeshiv Eretz HaNegev. Amalek is sitting in the south. Amalek was living in Israel at that time. They came from Israel to fight the Jews. Amalek was sitting in the Eretz HaNegev. Okay? By the way, which was the first Shalom Aleichem to go up. They went in the south. Who did they say, we're going to go up to the south to conquer the land. The first nation you're going to meet is the Amalek that made us problems last time. The nation of Chiti, Yevusi, and Amorite live on the mountains, meaning there's no way, because the guys that live on top of a mountain has an advantage, right? The people are coming up the mountain, you just shoot them down. V'aknani yeshiv al hayam, and the Knanites live by the sea, and al yad ha-yarden, and in the yarden. So basically they're saying, there's no way we could do this. Okay? Amalek is strong, they're not going to give up the land, and from, as they say in Yiddish, von alle Seiten, from any angle that you want to look at it, it's no good. It's not going to work.
They didn't say it's not good yet. They just
yes, they said.
Where?
Well, we're not done yet, but
no, it's coming up. Yeah.
No, but they said this people are very strong.
Yeah, but that's just a definition. It doesn't say we're not stronger.
No, but that word "f" is "but," it has a terrible implication.
But
if they didn't say "fs," the Ramban explains, and they just said the nation is strong.
Right.
That's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu told them. See if they're strong or weak. The Ramban comments the key word in their report, lacking in faith, was the word F is but. Okay? If they're coming back to say facts, they could have said they're strong people. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu told them to find out. Once you say, but that is a very strong implication.
Between the good and the bad.
Yes. Okay. Vayaz Kaliv is Amal Moshe. So before Kaliv started, the Gemara says, Yeshua started telling the Meraglim, be quiet. The pasuk doesn't say that, but the Gemara in Seita says. The Gemara in Seita discusses this whole story at very, very great length. The Gemara says Yeshua started defending the land. I mean, Kalev is not going to speak for Yeshua. Yeshua was a future leader. Yeshua was, you know. So they said to him, Reish Ketiyah, that's what the Gemara's expression. Rashi says he didn't have any children, Yeshua, at this time. So they said, look who's talking. He doesn't have any kids. They're not going to go into Israel. They're not going to get killed. What does he care? Of course he's going to defend the land. And they wanted to kill him. And Hashem made a miracle that they couldn't kill Yeshua. So now Kalev started. But Kalev did it a different tactic. Kalev said, okay, we'll see. Vayas Kalev v'sa'am al Moshe. Kalev quieted the nation. He got him all quiet. And he said like this. What does it mean, El Moshe? It's a very funny expression. He quieted the nation to Moshe. Moshe's not even talking over here. What do you mean he quieted the nation to Moshe? So Rashi says also from the Gemara. He said, you think this is at all Moshe Rabbeinu did to us? He made it sound in a negative way. You think this is all Moshe Rabbeinu did for us? So they all of a sudden they got quiet to hear more bad about Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu is the culprit over here wanting to take the Jews into Israel. So he says, everybody got quiet. And then he said, what are you talking about? Moshe Rabbeinu split the sea for us. He conquered Egypt for us. And then he starts saying, he gave us the man, he gave us the love. If Moshe Rabbeinu says to do it, we could do it. But meanwhile, he got everybody's attention. And that's how Kalev did it. Sometimes you have to do things to quiet down the mob, and then you can talk rational. Now, the Gemara says, as we all know, the Meraglim came back Tisha B'Av night. Mm-hmm. The 40 days ended Tisha B'Av night. And as we'll soon see in the Pesukim, the Jews were crying and screaming and yelling, we're not going. So the Gemara says, Hashem said to the Jews, now you're crying for nothing. I'm going to give you what to cry for. And therefore both the temples were destroyed on Tisha B'Av, because Hashem said, now you're crying for nothing, I'm going to give you what to cry for tonight. And therefore the Gemara says, after the decree, because we're going to finish, and this is the last class until after Sukkot. So it says that every year on Tisha B'Av, everybody knows the decree was that when they turned 60, when everybody's going to die in the 40 years in the desert. Right? So how did they die in the desert? So the Gemara says, every year, and what's the chesed in 40 years? Because Hashem didn't want anybody to die under 60. Because the heavenly death, Karis, is 60. So Hashem said, nobody's going to die under 60. Okay? The decree was between the ages of 20 and 60. Under 20 is not punishable by heaven. Okay? So Hashem said, listen, every year on Tisha B'Av, whoever turned 60 that year went out of the Jewish camp. They dug their own graves. Very easy. They lay down to sleep and they didn't wake up. This went on every Tisha B'Av day or night of Tisha B'Av. They dug their own graves. Everybody that hit 60 that year, that was their birthday present.
Not all died.
Huh?
Some got up.
No. For the 40 years, they all died. The last year, Hashem undid the decree early, a year early. So when they dug their grave on Tisha B'Av, the next morning they got up. So they thought they didn't have satellite times and dates. They said, maybe it's not Tisha B'Av. Maybe we made a mistake. So the next night again they lay down in the grave. And again and again. Until the 15th of Av, Tu B'Av. They saw it was a full moon. So they knew it was the 15th of the month. So they knew Tisha B'Av passed. So they knew the decree was over. And that's why one of the reasons why Tu B'Av, Chamisha Asa B'Av, the 15th of Av, is such a big Yom Tov. Because the people in the Midbar stopped dying.
So there are some 60s that went into Eretz Yisrael with Yoshua?
The last year. Uh-huh. The people from the last year. Don't tell me. You know how old you are?
Yeah, but
how did they know?
They don't have any certificates or anything.
You only know from your birth certificate?
Yeah, we may forget.
Some people never look at their birth certificate.
Most people know.
People know. I'll tell you what they didn't know. I know in Europe, the people like in my in-laws' generation in Europe, a lot of them don't know when their real birthday is.
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying.
A lot of them don't know when their birthdays are because not only that, they went with false passports, they had false dates, and they had to remember, you know, brainwash themselves of the new date of birth in case they got stopped.
They also went out from Egypt where they didn't have any clue.
But they knew their age, you know their age.
From Egypt,
they knew their age. Okay, anyway, that's it until after.